Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report Strategy Series. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Over the weekend, the ISIS-K terror group killed 144 and wounded 150 more at a concert hall outside Moscow. Although Washington warned Russia before the attack that the group was targeting public venues in Moscow, Vladimir Putin is blaming Ukraine as being behind the attacks and vowing to press ahead in his war to conclusion. Joining us today to discuss what Russia will do against Ukraine and what's next is my good friend, Dr. Eugene Rumer, the director of the Russia and Eurasia program at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He also served as a former national intelligence officer for Russia and Eurasia on the National Intelligence Council. Eugene, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me again.
A real pleasure. I'm sorry our mutual friend Sam Bendett of the Center for Naval Analysis wasn't able to join us today, but he's going to be joining us next week for our almost weekly updates on the war. Before we get started, our coverage of strategy, strategic issues, and conversations with leading thinkers is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, the late, great Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. This strategy series is not affiliated with the Andrew W. Marshall Foundation. Eugene, Vladimir Putin has admitted that the attack was on the Crocus City Hall, concert hall, was by ISIS-K, but he blamed Ukraine for being behind the attack somehow, an attack that came a week after his smirking re-election with 87% majority of the vote, which you and Sam were kind enough to join us last week to discuss. Putin's compact with Russians has been, give me your freedom and I'm going to give you a comfortable and secure life. But that compact in some ways is getting rickety. What does this attack mean? What effect is it having on the Russian psyche? And what effect is it having on that compact that Russia has, that Putin has offered the Russian people?
Well, Vago, I'm afraid that this compact exists only in the minds of analysts like you and me, that the Russian people are basically prepared to eat up whatever official propaganda is serving to them. So, I mean, if anybody is asking themselves in Moscow, how come we were supposed to be more secure as a result of the so-called special military operation against Ukraine, and Ukrainian drones are striking refineries all over Russia, all over European Russia, terrorist attacks are taking place in Moscow. This compact is not the real thing. You know, there's no quid pro quo here. The Russian people are basically, unfortunately, have been brainwashed into believing the official Kremlin propaganda. I think that a recent interview that an NPR correspondent had with a Russian woman who seemed to be completely in thrall of Putin and said, you know, why are these Ukrainians attacking us? What have we ever done to them? Now, is there a better reflection of how average Russians subjected to this propaganda for decades now think of the situation? So if you ask what this means for, you know, the future, I think it's more of the same.
Let me take you to that question that you raised, right? I mean, the Russian people, as you said, it's not a quid pro quo. It's not like there was any agreement on the part of Russians. There are no other candidates to vote for, right? And if there is an up-and-coming candidate, they end up getting shot in the shadow of the Kremlin or dying in a penal colony in the Arctic. Yes. Russians are locked in a tank of so many falsehoods that reality is deliberately distorted, right, to your point. How do we have any sense? And I mean, obviously we look at polls in Russia and I've always said that these polls are false because Russians never are really that honest with somebody who they meet on the street asking them questions, but ultimately they're not stupid either. Right. And even during Soviet times, people were informed about what the reality was, even if they were going along with the system. How do we know how much information is actually penetrating the web of lies? Like, the Russians actually may have a clearer understanding of what's happening? Or does it really not matter ultimately if they have no agency?
Well, you know, we don't have, as you said, a good feel for how the Russian society really is divided into various groups based on what we saw, 10, 15 years ago. There was this creative class that was emerging in Russia, and those were educated, well-to-do, thinking people, but they had access to the internet. Most Russians still have access to the internet. If you want to read, if you want to find out what's going on, you can. But the majority of the public really was not interested, seemed to be quite indifferent. Navalny, was a hero to all of us in the West and many in Russia, but those many in Russia were really a small minority. So we saw tens of thousands of people going to his grave to lay flowers. But really, in a city of 12, 14 million people like Moscow, it's not really a significant segment of the population. I think the public generally has accepted that, life is good enough. The horrible 1990s are no longer threatening to us, the time when Russia was really devastated. And these days, if you protest, the oppressive apparatus loyal to the regime will come down hard on you. So, it breeds the kind of indifference or the kind of, as you call it, compact, where people are more or less free to live their private lives without any manifestations of, public discontent. And for a large segment of the population, what they see on TV is the reality. And we know that. We see that day in, day out.
Putin, speaking of distorted reality, Putin is blaming Ukraine ultimately for the attacks, right? Somebody was behind it, as opposed to saying, well, it was just ISIS-K and they're mounting operations, or whether they've been foiled on Germany, on the Netherlands, and other countries. Does this change anything in how the war is going to be prosecuted? Because, people were looking at this as, all right, well, he's going to escalate somehow. You and I had an exchange over the weekend about this. What more can Putin do that he's not already doing? And how does he escalate? Because he's always able to escalate something and do something differently, if for no other reason than to transmit to the public he's doing something different. What should we be expecting in the West to come out of this?
To be honest, Vago, I am somewhat at a loss here because I don't know what else he can do to Ukraine. So there can be more strikes against Ukrainian infrastructure, as there seem to be happening already. Now, is this going to be more of a persistent pattern, or one-off, on again, off again? It's hard to tell. A lot will depend on just the sheer amount of hardware that the Russians have at their disposal to carry on these attacks. But I think, the fact that now this attack is being attributed not only to ISIS, not only to Ukraine, but also to their manipulators, their puppeteers in the West, suggests to me that the crackdown will take place inside the country even more than it's been happening up until now. So, the security services will be going after even the slightest manifestations of discontent, dissent, any kind of sign of opposition or disagreement, even passive with the regime. I don't know what else the regime has to offer, really.
You've been obviously a longtime observer, and indeed born in Russia. Your dad was also a very prominent intellectual dealing with Soviet affairs. Does this reversion to almost an increasingly Stalinist state surprise you?
Well, in some ways, this regime has already surpassed a Stalinist state. The sentences that are being meted out to people like Navalny or Vladimir Karamurza exceed the sentences that were meted out to the enemies of the people in the 1930s and 40s and early 50s. I'm not sure what else the regime can do. Back in those days, there were mass purges of periodic mass purges of officials. I just don't see the regime going to such lengths to institute that kind of terror because things have changed because it's not
Right,
really a
you can't
Stalinist
kill,
regime.
yeah,
We're, sorry.
you can't execute millions of people and charge them for the bullets anymore, right? I mean, it
Right.
becomes.
Yeah, I mean, Stalin did that in the 1930s, and but it's I just don't see that happening. The argument that the regime, the officials are loyal to the regime, doesn't really work in this situation because in the 1930s those officials were loyal to the regime as well. But I just don't see that happening in modern day Russia.
It is.
I'm really at a loss here to see what else Putin can do, persecute, go after ethnic Ukrainians inside Russia, of whom there's still probably quite a few, who are Russian citizens. Unlikely. I think it's going to be just a more oppressive, more comprehensive terror, more designations of people as foreign agents or undesirables. Maybe purges of Central Asian migrants. I saw the other day a statement from the Kyrgyzstan Foreign Ministry warning Kyrgyz citizens not to travel to Russia for the obvious reasons. They didn't specify the reasons, but they just said, we suggest you not travel now. Perhaps, unleashing a campaign of targeted assassinations. Going after Ukrainian leaders. My imagination is not that good to really go that far.
It is interesting though that all you have to do to lose your job is for somebody to pass along to the authorities that you have said something critical about the special operation. And so that's why in some respects, right, neighbor denouncing neighbor and sending in train actions is interesting. And the notion, as my dad used to say, right, the walls have ears, and you always have to be very careful what you say and who you say it to. Let me take you, you were talking about a retaliation and certainly ratcheting up operations at home, especially towards Central Asians, right? I mean, it looks like all of the folks unfortunately involved were, at least they claim to be Central Asians, although it's unclear with the entire maskirovka of the society whether or not the, who are these guys? Were they the ones who actually perpetrated this? Is unfortunately, it would be not illegitimate to question whether what we're seeing is reality. But let's assume that these are the guys who did it. What's, the United States would be mounting a military attack on the other side of the planet, right? Targeted special operations raids or whatever. What's Russia's a bit, first, what is its appetite to respond to a terror group in Syria, right? A franchise terror group in Syria and in Afghanistan. And what's its ability to be able to execute operations like that?
Well, supposedly they have operatives in many countries. The question is, are they able to carry out these operations? And again, as you rightly ask, again, how did, the investigation is so corrupted now that, they can carry out a strike somewhere in Syria and claim that this is in retaliation for the Crocus attack. But we'll never know. Everything is not maskirovka, but everything is pretend. It's like pretend retaliatory operations. They can very well do that. No, they have those capabilities. They can launch airstrikes from their base in Syria. Whether or not we'll ever know that these strikes were really carried out in retaliation against real ISIS targets, against real perpetrators and their sponsors or manipulators, we'll never know.
Let me just ask you about the notion of being able to cooperate with Russia, right? I mean, we've had a sense of being on parallel tracks, that we can be fighting and on be on opposite sides on Ukraine, but still be able to work together on some global issues. And the United States, taking them at their word, advised the Russians that there was a terror threat. And the Russians don't appear maybe to have done as much about that as maybe they should have, right? Right. I mean, we'll see more, but it's impossible to know what the investigation takes. What does this tell us about sort of the nature of the relationship?
Well, it tells us that the idea that we can somehow cooperate with Russia on CT issues is really preposterous. Considering the mistrust and considering the tendency that the Russian services have to exploit what information we give them for their own propaganda purposes, how can we cooperate with these people? You know, Putin, 4 days, I think, before the attack, used the information that our intelligence agencies supposedly, reportedly shared with the Russian services, used it for propaganda purposes. So it just makes a mockery of the whole proposition. And there are many other reasons. You know, we in the Russians view terrorism in very different light. We see it as a global issue. They see it as a geopolitical issue. They're always prone to misusing whatever information we share with them for their own either domestic political or propaganda purposes. So that just really kind of, you know, rules out any future such possibility until there's a very different set of circumstances in Russia. My former colleague, a senior CIA officer, now retired, Steve Hall, published a very good article on the Carnegie website about the pitfalls of cooperating with Russia on intelligence sharing and CT issues. I highly recommend it.
Indeed, not exactly the most trustworthy nation to work on just about anything with. This was a horrific act. It was a bloodbath. And assuming these are, you know, the folks who were involved, as I just mentioned, what's fascinating is that state media has disclosed that one was forced to eat his ear and he showed up in a Moscow court with a bandaged head. The other one was shown on state media with a car battery attached to his genitals, which is a frequent FSB technique. And what I find, you know, I mean, that's shocking for a government to reveal that, right? I mean, I don't know how many pictures there are of waterboarding, but it's not like the U.S. government was advertising that. In fact, got in trouble for doing it surreptitiously. And then, you know, the explanation of it after the fact. What does this tell you, right? What is the government is transmitting something, both domestically and internationally, by doing this? What are the messages they're sending? And what I find fascinating is those in the United States saying, boy, these guys really are tough. That's how you respond to something like this. Attaboy. Boy, we ought to be doing stuff like that, which is also sort of generally incompatible, right? I'm with John McCain on this one. We should not be in that business of doing that. And eye for eye, tooth for tooth is not necessarily a right way of doing it. What is the message Russia is sending? And are you surprised that it's, you know, in some quarters getting admiration and traction?
I'm not surprised that this message is getting admiration and traction in some quarters, simply because, it's the nature of, unfortunately, the society that we live in, some segments of our society, for the same reason that Putin appears to be popular in some corners of our, you know, political spectrum. But what it says is that, you know, this is a brutal regime. It's advertising, it's thriving on its brutality. And it's sending a message that if you attempt something like this and if you're caught alive, this is what will happen to you. The same way that, the Russians are now carrying out operations, attempted and real assassinations in Europe, as was the case in Berlin in 2019, if I'm not mistaken, as was the case in the UK with Skripal in Salisbury, as was the case with many other unexplained health incidents or poisonings of various dissidents. I think the message here really is to instill fear. There's no other. There's no other purpose to it. I at least I don't see it. It's like during the day of Ivan the Terrible, opричники, Ivan's enforcement guard, drove around, rode around with severed dogs' heads, I think, tied to their saddles. It was, it's a message to really to terrorize.
Unfortunately, that's been a repeated theme in Russian history. It's worked domestically. It's not abundantly clear that it's been as successful
Yeah.
internationally.
And
We
tragically, if I may, we're coming back to this Ivan the Terrible era, which brings to mind a dystopian novel by a great Russian contemporary writer, Vladimir Sorokin, "День опричника," Day of the Opричnik, that sort of paints the picture of 21st century Russia that is very much like the Putin regime, but with heavy overtones being, Russia being also sort of a minor dependency of a greater Chinese empire. It's all happening before our very eyes. I highly recommend that book. I believe it's been translated and available on Amazon.
It is you've mentioned that book before, and I think it's well worth checking out, and I will check it out now as a consequence. Let me ask you a little bit about the response, right? The Western response. Our response has been international sanctions, a lot of pressure, companies divesting themselves of their operations, which then gave Putin more rewards to the oligarch class to
Right.
placate them. And we've been very porous on our sanctions because the White House has been concerned about energy prices, so it's actually allowing a lot of people to get away with stuff that they shouldn't be allowing them to get away with, in part to make sure that there's a liquid, energy market around the world to reduce prices here, especially in an election. Election year where gas prices were running high. The administration has toughened sanctions. Europeans have toughened sanctions. Are any of these tougher sanctions having any impact at all? Right? Because, folks were saying these are unprecedented and Russia will be brought to its knees. It's a closed internal market. They're spending money on weapons. It's, they're Russians are still going to Starbucks, even if it's not called Starbucks, and they're eating at McDonald's, even if it's not called McDonald's. What are these sanctions having any effect? And if not, what's the next thing that folks ought to be considering if we want to make any change at all, right? Do we have to enforce secondary sanctions? And that's not even clear. We've threatened the Chinese, but the Chinese are still getting the Russians everything they need on drones or anything else. What's the next step of this? Or are we just going through motions to say we went through motions?
Look, I vehemently disagree with the proposition that sanctions are not working. Sanctions are working. But I think we tend to forget that sanctions are not a fire and forget tool in our foreign national security, foreign economic policy. You can't just impose sanctions and say, okay, I'm done. Enforcement becomes the critical piece of our sanctions policy, and it's cat and mouse, whack-a-mole to some extent, but it has to be continuously fine-tuned, adapted, changed to the changing circumstances. So the Russians are adapting, but we should be adapting too. So the fact that we have cut off, effectively have been able to cut off a huge portion of Russian trade with Europe hurts a lot. The fact that they've been cut off from Western technology, that's not a tightly, it's not a tight seal that Russian attempts to circumvent sanctions cannot penetrate, but it hurts. It hurts. So I think we should be more creative, more diligent, more persistent in applying already existing sanctions, in thinking about new ways. We should be going after this shadow Russian tanker fleet. We should be going after Sovcomflot. I think it's the Russian shipping agency. After that fleet, as we're already doing. So it has to be an ongoing process, not a thing where we have imposed sanctions and, you know, turned away and moved on to something else. So absolutely, I think it's absolutely essential.
I agree with you. I would like us to be a little bit more tighter, to make that seal a little bit tighter, because stuff is going through third nations.
On sanctions, if I may, Vago. I think the thing that really somehow we have not done is we haven't gone extensively after Russian elites. You know, we talk about the oligarchs and we've sanctioned this oligarch and that oligarch. That's not really the point. I think, you know, the handful of so-called oligarchs, several dozen of them, they're not really going to apply pressure against Putin. But I think we should be going after people who are part of the regime, not so much the oligarchs who run this company or that company, although I have no special feelings toward them. But Navalny's organization published a list of some 5,000 people who are connected to the regime, their relatives, their children, their mothers-in-law, who are enjoying the benefits of virtually unimpeded access to the West. They own property in the West, yet they're loyal supporters, members of the ruling regime. They should not be benefiting from this.
I couldn't agree with you more on that.
Yeah, you know, if the daughter of or the wife of the of Putin's press secretary can enjoy vacations in France, or, you know, post Instagram pictures of their trips on fancy yachts, that's your target. Go after these people.
I agree with you, Eugene, and I'm sort of stunned why everybody allows it, right? News media, whether they're in France, in Germany, or elsewhere, in Switzerland, you know, have made a point of evidencing this. And yet we are still not moving the needle, because unfortunately there's a very large economy that supports these guys, right? They've got a lot of money.
Absolutely.
They buy super yachts. You know, I think it should be intolerable that, you know, Gulf nations, the United Arab Emirates, has served as host to a lot of pretty unsavory people and helping them hide their assets. The Swiss are not doing as good of a job, right? We were enthusiastic in the beginning. Oh my God, the Swiss are, it looks like they've a little bit of backsliding there on the part of our Swiss friends. Let me ask you one last question. So it's interesting to me that Putin does things that have a tendency of sometimes backfiring, right? NATO was a problem. Now NATO is bigger. All of Europe is, you know, spending more money to better defend itself against Russia. You know, there's still talk about Transnistria and a couple of other places where Putin could make mischief. Some of these places are landlocked. Okay, there's not easy free access to get there if the Moldovans, for example, don't want there to be movement to get there. Mike Johnson, the House Speaker, is now saying that America must do the right thing and support Ukraine. And that's terrific. And it's interesting that it comes right after, you know, Putin is vowing now to put greater pressure on Ukraine. So I wonder if this is another sort of backfire on his part. At any rate, how important is this aid? Are the Europeans making it up? And where do we stand right now? Because the most precious commodity Ukraine has is actually its people. And unfortunately, its losses have been very high, whether to take territory or whether to defend territory across a very vast front, where the Russians really are stepping up pressure, even as the Ukrainians hold their own and really hit some blows deep into Russia and particularly in the Black Sea. What's your sense on, you know, how Ukraine is doing and what its prospects are and how important that next tranche of U.S. aid is?
I think that the next tranche of U.S. assistance is extremely important. And if this tragedy and Putin's reaction somehow, if they move Speaker Johnson to proceed with the aid package, that would be, you know, a great outcome, at least for us, for Ukraine, coming out of this terrible situation. Without this assistance, by every indication, Ukraine is having a hard time. So, my colleagues, Dara Massagot and Mike Kaufman, have a very good piece that they published in various forums, including, I think, in War on the Rocks, where they suggest what seems to be a very sensible way forward for Ukraine to transition to a posture of active strategic defense. And in the meantime, to recapitalize, reconstitute, retrain their armed forces for future operations in 2025. So the 2024 becomes kind of the year to rebuild. That seems to be the strategy that's being adopted by the Ukrainians now. Of course, as you mentioned, manpower, they're facing difficult choices on draft because, there are obvious political sensitivities there. To come back to your original question, I think the issue of U.S. assistance is absolutely vital under the circumstances because our European allies are stepping up, but that's not enough. It's just not enough.
And in 30 seconds, and you would be supportive of the EU proposal to use Russian assets with which to bolster Ukraine and help rebuild it.
I am supportive, but I'm also realistic that those Russian assets are located in multiple jurisdictions, and the issue is certain to be litigated for years and years and years. So, yes, I'm very supportive, but I just don't see that happening quickly. So, that's not an escape that we can use under the circumstances. We still need to provide that assistance to Ukraine and not look for some alternative theories of how that assistance can be paid for with someone else's money. Although I believe that money legitimately should go to Ukraine, no question about it.
Eugene, always a pleasure having you on the program. Thanks very much for joining us. We appreciate it and look forward to having you back on the show soon. Thanks so much and all the best to the family.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to all of you for joining us. We appreciate it very much. We'll be back again tomorrow with Dr. Daryl Bricker of Ipsos Public Affairs to give us a view of global polling on hot button issues, everything from the U.S. election to Russia, China, Israel, and more. Join us tomorrow. Until then, have a great day.